I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, our guest today is Zach Lifton. He's a hazards geologist at the Idaho Geological Survey. Today we're talking about the Snake River Basin and why it looks like a giant smiley face in the middle of North America. Have you ever noticed that, Peter?
Yeah. There's
this big smile.
Yeah, it's all of southern Idaho. And, you know, all of us have been through the Snake River Plain. And today we're going to find out how we got that smile.
How did we get the smile? I like that.
Yeah.
It's a good topic for season 8, Peter.
Yeah.
8 years of this.
Are you getting tired of me yet?
You look better than ever.
Yeah, thanks. I got braces.
You got braces.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Helping your smile.
Helping my smile. Yeah.
See how I pulled that together?
TMJ disorder. It's helping that.
Well, get rid of the TMJ.
Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us about some nature news.
Yeah. Leif, have you ever thought to yourself, you know, I think I'm getting a cold and I probably should eat some kimchi?
The first one, but maybe not the second
one. Not the second one. You probably want to go to vitamin C or something
else
like that.
Maybe some orange juice, yeah.
Well, that is the wrong choice, good sir. Scientists from the World Institute of Kimchi, which is a legit...
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The World Institute of Kimchi?
Yeah, I looked them up on the web, and they are, yeah, they're serious.
And is it in Korea, at least?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Legit.
So they have found that regular kimchi consumption can help strengthen immune cell function while keeping the immune system in balance.
Can you remind me what kimchi is?
Yeah, it's fermented cabbage.
Yeah. So it's kind of slightly overdone cabbage.
Well, it's not overdone. It's just been...
It's been fermenting.
Yeah, fermenting with a bunch of different other stuff involved with it as well.
Pretty strong flavor,
And it can be spicy as well. So,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the Institute conducted a 12-week clinical trial with three groups of people, one who consumed a placebo, another one with kimchi powder from naturally fermented kimchi.
All right.
And then another from a starter culture fermentation method.
All right.
What they found is that participants who consumed kimchi experienced enhanced activity in antigen-presenting cells, which play a key role in detecting bacteria and viruses and signaling immune cells, and that, this is a cell, the CD4 plus T cells developed in both protective and regulatory types in a balanced way.
All right.
And so basically, kimchi functions as a precision regulator, boosting immune defenses when needed, while preventing excess or unnecessary immune reactions.
Well, that's a pretty good thing. So how often are you eating kimchi?
Well, you should probably eat it every day.
Every day, or just at the onset of a cold.
No, I think the Kimchi World Institute or the World Institute of Kimchi would suggest every day.
Every day.
Yeah, and you know, you can make it at home as well, so.
Does it involve leaving cabbage in the fridge too long?
Yes.
Because I've done that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I actually did
There's probably more to it than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I did look at some kimchi recipes, and they're quite varied, so you just have to find the recipe that suits you.
All right. Well, there's your health tip for the new year. Kimchi for everyone. Today's trivia question deals with our guest today. So what year was the Idaho Geologic Survey formed here in Idaho? It's been a while. When we come back from the break, Zach Lifton is going to join us, and he's going to talk all about what they do over there at the survey, but more importantly, why we have a big smile in Idaho.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Nature of Idaho, or ISU's Research, Innovation, and Creativity Insights? Sometimes it's tough to hear your favorite KISU shows live, but you can listen to them on demand with our free KISU mobile app for your Apple or Android device. Search your app store for KISU to get started.
Hey, we're back from the break. We want to welcome our guest today, Zach Lifton. He's from the Idaho Geological Survey. Welcome to The Nature of Idaho.
Hi, how are you guys doing? It's great to be here.
Well, we're doing well over here in Pocatello. First off, hey, tell us about yourself and what it is you do.
Sure. Yeah, like you said, I'm a hazards geologist with the Idaho Geological Survey. We are a state agency, and our mission is to provide geologic data to the public. And so that geologic data can take the form of maps or databases or reports. And, you know, the survey covers a lot of different topics, not just hazards, but mapping, economic geology, petroleum geology, hydrogeology. And we have people working on a lot of different projects all over the state.
Well, Idaho's a gigantic state, as I'm sure you're more than aware. That seems like a lot of ground to cover.
And the geology is exactly the same no matter where you go.
Well, Idaho is a big state. It's as big as some countries, and the geology is really diverse. That is one of the things that makes the job really exciting, is there's lots of different stuff to study. It's also not been studied really thoroughly yet. I mean, some parts of it have, but there's still a lot of geologic questions that remain. So there's a lot of exciting work to be done, which makes the job fun.
Can I ask you, what is the most asked question of you in the IGS?
Okay, I think the most asked question generally would be, is this a meteorite? We get a lot of calls. And
me too, at the museum. That's the number one question I get. Is this a fossil or is this a meteorite?
Yep. And then for me in particular, I usually get a lot of questions about ground shaking or vibration or humming. And usually people end up talking to me because they think it's maybe a seismic issue. And so, yeah, I get quite a lot of calls about that.
Yeah, I believe that. And it is a seismically active state for sure. And we have had recent sizable enough events that people will feel the ground shake and things moving.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's rocking and rolling for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's great to be part of such a large, interesting state, a very active state. But we got you on the line today to talk about the big smile in the middle of our state, or I guess in the lower part of it. It's pretty noticeable as soon as like satellite images started coming out. It's a really conspicuous feature in the U.S. So what's the deal with the big smiley face?
Yeah, it is really noticeable. It's, you know, if you look at a map of the U.S. or even just, you know, a Google Earth satellite image of the world with no borders on it, it's really easy to find Idaho because that smiley face is very distinct. It's really unique. We call it the Snake River Plain. It's got an interesting story, which I think we'll kind of dig into here, but it involves volcanoes and faults and rivers and floods and lakes. There's a lot of stuff going on along the Snake River Plain. And of course, it's also, you know, one of the most populated parts of our state. That's where many of the biggest cities and most of the population lives in Idaho.
So let's talk first about the eastern side of the Snake River Plain, because I think everyone has an idea at least how it was formed and how the Yellowstone hotspot is involved in this. For me, what kind of surprised me is actually where the first hotspot caldera eruption happened. And right now it's sitting in Nevada and Oregon. And so when we trace the route of the Snake River Plain, it really kind of has, you know, it's moved quite a ways.
Yeah, so the basic story with the Eastern Snake River Plain is that it basically follows the track of the hotspot. Geologists have mapped out different calderas or explosive centers of previous versions of the Yellowstone hotspot. So as the plate has been moving, the hotspot has been stationary and it's kind of been burning a hole through the crust, so to speak. That is pretty well defined. We know about when it started and there's maybe six or seven of these explosive centers leading up to the modern day Yellowstone caldera. But I think, you know, what you referred to, the starting point at the Idaho, Nevada, and Oregon border is interesting because it basically traces a straight line from there to the modern day Yellowstone caldera. But the Snake River Plain is a smiley face. It's like sort of a crescent or a half circle. I think there's maybe a misconception that the hotspot took that curved track, but in fact, it's a pretty straight line. And the western side is kind of a different story, but the eastern Snake River Plain, you're right, is really just related to that hotspot. And there's a lot of interesting volcanic evidence there that leads us to believe that.
So the eastern half of the smile, let's say, that's more or less a straight line that you could draw on the map from, like you're saying, the Nevada-Idaho border, a little west of Twin Falls.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Twin Falls is kind of in this sort of
south of the center point, right?
Part, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's kind of a good dividing line. And so everything east of that is the Eastern Snake River Plain, west of that is west. We've got all these volcanic centers, and so the Eastern Snake River Plain is really, it's sort of this low-lying, relatively flat plain that's just filled in with volcanics, basalt and rhyolite mostly.
So help me understand why. We'll just divide and we'll just talk about the eastern part from Twin Falls out to Yellowstone. Let's keep it simple, I guess, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it flat? Why is there a plain there?
Okay, so the thinking on that is that as the plate moved over the hot spot,
right,
it's moving very slowly. So the hot spot has time to kind of heat up the lower part of the crust. And so as heat and melted material are coming up and sort of injecting or erupting onto the surface there, a lot of that material is dense. It's basalt. It's denser than some of the continental crust. And so you're densifying that little stretch of the crust there. And because our crust is kind of quote unquote floating on top of the mantle, if you have a denser crust, it kind of rides a little bit lower in that mantle. And so the idea is that you've created a denser patch of crust. It starts sinking down and sort of settling into the mantle a little bit lower. And we see evidence of that on the margins of the plain as well, because if you look at a map or a satellite images of the plain, there's all these mountain ranges that come up to the edge of the plain, right, and then are just sort of cut off very dramatically,
right,
on both sides, on the north and south side of the plain. At the ends of those mountain ranges on either side, the rocks kind of warp down towards the plain.
Right.
And so the thinking is that everything just kind of flexed and warped downward.
And you can see that dramatic cutoff here in Pocatello.
Yeah,
you just
right on the line there.
Yeah, we're right on the line. You get up into, you're out hiking and you can just see right into the plain, and all of a sudden the Portland Atlantic just stop.
And if it's a clear day, you'll see the Snake River Plain and you'll see some of the volcanic centers out in the middle of it towards the National Lab. But on a clear day, you can see clear across to the Lost Rivers, the Lemhis, and the Beaverheads, which is a continuation of those more or less north-south mountains that have been cut off by the Snake River Plain itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's pretty dramatic.
So these are big, I mean, these are big scale features that we're talking about here. And it takes a bit of an imagination to, you know, imagine like slowly a series of volcanoes are occurring from Twin Falls, slowly proceeding toward the modern day location of Yellowstone. Do we have an understanding for when that activity, let's say in Twin Falls, would have been happening? When were the volcanoes happening then?
Yeah, so those volcanic craters or those explosive centers that you talked about are pretty well dated. I mean, there's some uncertainty there, but the eruption at what's called the Twin Falls caldera was about 10.5 million years ago to about 8.5 million years ago. So it was active for a period of time before that center of activity kind of shifted to the northeast. And so that sequence that we described starting in Nevada, though, that one started about 16.5 million years ago. So there's kind of this long chain. And each volcanic center usually lives for about 2 million years before the crust has moved far enough to kind of create a new area of activity. So from Twin Falls about 10.5 million years ago, things have kind of marched to the northeast until its present location.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So, and it's a progression, right? From 16 million, they get successively more recent until you get to the Yellowstone. And so that can account for like that half, that eastern half of the Snake River Plain. We've got dense crust. The dense crust sinks lower. And I guess rivers then find the low spot, water finds the low spot and flows through. So that maybe helps account for why the Snake River is flowing along that eastern segment, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I think maybe you're segueing towards, if the Eastern Snake River Plain is formed by volcanic activity, what formed the Western Snake River Plain?
Right.
Am I reading the room?
Spot on. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Despite it looking like one very continuous plain, which is, you know, physically the river flows right through it without really knowing the difference. But the western side was actually formed by what we think was faulting, probably indirectly related to the passage of the hotspot. That hotspot moving, or the crust moving over it, triggered lots of different things happening, you know, all over the Northwest. But the idea is that it formed this big graben. So there are normal faults on either side pointing towards each other. That block in the middle that's dropping down, we call it a graben, formed the Western Snake River Plain. So it as the crust extended on either side, that block dropped down and created this basin, essentially. And so, you know, in terms of the hydrology, again, it sort of created that space or that path for the river to flow.
So within that graben, is it the same types of rock? Is it basalt, or are we looking at something that's different?
That's a great question. It's kind of a mixed bag. The Western Snake River Plain mostly is sediments that have filled in that graben, but there are quite a bit of, you know, smaller, thinner deposits or flows of basalt. And so there's some much younger volcanic activity happening there, probably related to the Yellowstone hotspot, but a little bit more peripheral. So it's not heat directly from the hotspot, but, you know, maybe some residual heat, you know, that's just kind of expanding out from some of these old calderas. But there are some basalt lava flows that are much younger, maybe 2 million years ago, or maybe even younger, that are kind of interbedded into the sediments there. But for the most part, the Western Snake River Plain is sediment. And that's a really distinct signature on that side of the state. You know, if you know where to look, you can see sort of light-colored, fine-grained sediments deposited on top of all the old volcanics. So, for example, I think a really good example for me is the town of Bruno. If you're driving on, I think it's Highway 51, going north into Bruno, you come down through all these sort of red rhyolite rocks, and you come down into Bruno, and it's all this like white, powdery, very fine sediment everywhere. And that's some of that sediment that filled in that basin. And that's related to a really interesting story as well of Lake Idaho, an ancient lake that filled in that valley at one point.
Yeah. So let's make that connection, because I think there's an awareness across the state of this lake feature that no longer exists as a water body, but we have the sedimentary record that tells us that there was a gigantic lake that was filling in on the western side and in the Western Snake River Plain. Let's talk about Lake Idaho. Before I get there, we've got this graben. So this is a fault-related basin. So things are dropping down in the middle because the crust is getting pulled apart. So it drops down in the middle, we create a low spot, and that's the Western Snake River Plain. Water, again, likes to find the low spot. So Lake Idaho, how does it connect to Western Snake River Plain? And does it occupy that whole west?
Yeah, that's a great question. The idea, at least as far as I know, is that this graben created what we call accommodation space. So it's like a big hole. Like you said, water fills it in, and water carries sediment. And so about 10 million years ago, a little bit after the graben itself formed, we have evidence that this very large lake had formed in the Western Snake River Plain graben. We call it Lake Idaho. From about 10 million years ago until about 2.5 million years ago, this lake lived in this basin, and, you know, it fluctuated with the climate. You know, sometimes it would be high, sometimes it would be low, but there's a sedimentary record in the basin of this lake through that period. And there's sediment, really, it's almost like a bathtub ring. You know, depending on where you look, you can kind of follow this ring of sediment really all over Treasure Valley. And it went from almost Twin Falls all the way west, if you're driving on I-84, almost all the way west to Huntington, Oregon. So it covered a big area. It was a really big lake. It left behind lots of cool stuff. Leif, I think you could probably speak to the fossil record that was left behind, which is really fascinating. I don't know a lot about the fossils, but...
Sure. Well, and it's a little bit of everything that was alive around there at the time. Lakes are amazing at recording living things around them, because the sediments, as they're accumulating nicely, often preserve fossils really well. So you have, of course, all the fish that were living in the lake, and all the animals and mammals that were living around it. I've seen river otters, right, are in that deposit, and all sorts of hoofed mammals get recorded in there. So it's a really rich record around Lake Idaho.
Yeah, and a lot of that, as far as I know, is near Hagerman. Is that right?
It's throughout. Yeah, it depends where you are, but the Hagerman area and that whole Glens Ferry section, people will know from this show that my favorite drive when I'm going to Boise, which I do often, favorite part of the drive is Glens Ferry when it opens up, and it, gosh, it's just, you can see so much. It's beautiful.
Yeah. That area is really cool. It's also kind of a hot spot for landslides, incidentally. And, you know, that's some of the work that
absolutely,
you know, the river, the Snake River is the modern river, carving, you know, carved through some of that soft sediment. And in a lot of places that I mentioned that there's these thin layers of basalt, there's, you know, this cap rock of basalt on top of all this soft sediment that kind of holds it up. But once it gets eroded into these canyons, the sides erode and slough off into these landslides. So anyway, kind of a side note, but keeps us busy too.
So when we look at the east and west Snake River Plain, we know how culturally important and economically valuable it is for the state of Idaho. Is the soil different? You know, you've got two different types of formations, and, you know, do we have to manage, in a sense, how we use the soil and the landscape and water differently between the two types of, you know, formations?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I don't know if I have a great answer for it because I'm not a soil expert, but I think that, you know, just given the histories, the geologic histories of the two sides of the Snake River Plain, I think they do have different soils depending on where you are. You know, Eastern Snake River Plain is kind of dominated at the surface by basalt, and that weathers a certain way into a certain mineral assemblage. And so it's really good for certain things like growing potatoes. And then in Western Snake River Plain, you know, there's all that sandy, silty sediment from the lake, but there are also areas that are kind of capped by basalt. So I think maybe there's a bit of a mix there. You know, I think regardless of which part of the plain you're on, I think water management and erosion management are probably really important. You know, we have a pretty finite amount of water. More and more people are using it. There are definitely parts of the plain where we're pumping a lot of water out of the ground, maybe more than is being replenished naturally. Certainly that's the case in Raft River Valley, which is just south of the plain. But there are, I think, efforts to try to recharge some of those areas, you know, intentionally recharge some parts of the aquifer. Again, that's not really my area of expertise. So I think there's probably other people that could speak to that more clearly. But I think there are a lot of people thinking about it.
Yeah. Thinking along those lines, you know, more broadly about the Snake River Plain, it has been and will be a major east-west thoroughfare for travel, for commerce, for communication between the east and west across, you know, the Intermountain West. It divides or it cuts through what otherwise are rather impassable mountains. And so whether you're a fish or a person, you know, this is your way to get out west. And so we're seeing increased population, increased demand on water. We're seeing increased urbanization. These things are naturally going to progress over time. Within the survey, I'm really curious how the survey is able to kind of keep up with the progress and the demands, I guess, of growth, population growth, the need for resources, and making that information accessible for people that, you know, are stakeholders in this.
Yeah, well, that's a really good question also. You know, the survey tries to address a lot of issues that deal with that growth or use of resources. I mean, that traditionally geology has been kind of a resource-based field, you know, mining and oil extraction, things like that.
Yeah.
And so it has a history of dealing with those resources. And so, you know, we have an economic geologist that works on, you know, mineral resources. And surprisingly, one of the most important mineral resources in demand is aggregate material. So like sand and gravel for construction and road building and things like that, because it's just sand it's not gold or diamonds, but you need it for a lot of things, and it costs a lot of money to move it around. Knowing where those resources are and making sure that they're, you know, close to all the projects you're working on is really important. Water resources are extremely important. And we have a hydrogeologist that works on those issues. There's also other agencies in the state that work on that as well. The Idaho Department of Water Resources is kind of focused specifically on water and water allocation and use. My field of hazards also kind of touches on that growth aspect. You know, it's not so much resources, but as the population grows and Boise, Twin Falls, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, all these cities on the Snake River Plain have grown a lot in the last, you know, couple decades. You know, as we expand and build new things and build new infrastructure, those things intersect hazards. So landslides and faults and sinkholes and subsiding ground and things like that. And so that's certainly a big part of our mission, is to try to provide information that helps people manage those issues.
That's great. And we're grateful that the survey is doing the job that it's been doing. It's been doing it for a while. This is my segue to our trivia question. What year was the Idaho Geological Survey formed?
Can I reveal the answer?
Please reveal the answer. And tell us about the subtlety, because the name changed, right? So go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. So the survey has existed since 1919. And until 1984, it was called the Idaho Bureau of Mines and Geology. The home of the survey has kind of changed over the years. Because we're such a small agency, we're not really a standalone agency like the Transportation Department, for example. So currently we live in the University of Idaho. The state law that establishes us says you guys are a special program of the university, basically because we're so small. It would cost so much to have all the extra stuff to run an agency, you know, all the extra staff. And so we're administered by the university. But we've been part of the Department of Lands in the past, and maybe even other agencies long ago in the back in the history there that I don't actually know.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Zach, so much for joining us today to talk about the Snake River Plain. And for everyone listening, if you want to learn more and learn about Idaho's geology and landscape, please visit the Idaho Geological Survey at idahogeology.org.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU. Shows are produced at the KISU studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of all past episodes can be found at kisu.org and select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.